covenants. And by the way, I noticed last week that one of the brothers told me that I talked beyond the extended time for the tape. I don't mean to teach more than an hour on Sunday night. I usually try to teach about 45, 50 minutes in order to, that's a good time frame to develop the information. The last couple of weeks, the Abrahamic Covenant and the Mosaic Covenant, there's just so much information. And I didn't want to spread this thing out any further than it's going to be, five or six different covenants looking at them. So I was trying to get all that information in. So I'm going to put the caboose closer to the engine tonight in this covenant. I'll do that in the next couple of weeks. And in the future, what I'll try to do is just, if it takes breaking it into two, I'll do that. We don't have to be anxious. It's just us. We don't have any special pace we got to keep through this stuff. But I sometimes get a little desirous of making it get done, you know, quicker than not. Deuteronomy 29 is a fascinating passage, because this covenant, if you've got a scope of the Bible, it says the Palestinian covenant, and that's the way it identifies it at the very top of it there. And that's what we're going to call it, because this covenant does have to do with Israel's reception and possession of Palestine and of the land promises God gave Israel. You remember in the Abrahamic covenant, I tried to point out to you that each one of the three basic provisions in the Abrahamic covenant has another covenant that expands those things. The land, he promises Abraham the land, he promises him a great nation in the land, and then he promises him blessings. And those blessings particularly have to do with spiritual blessings. The Mosaic covenant that we looked at last time, Galatians says, was added. So you have the Abrahamic covenant here, and added on the side over here, standing beside the Abrahamic covenant, not a part of it, but standing outside of it over here, is the Mosaic covenant. And Galatians 3 says the Mosaic covenant is added. Now, it's not a part. It stands on the side. It's added over there. And that it doesn't annul the Abrahamic covenant. The Abrahamic covenant is not done away with, because the Mosaic covenant is put into effect. Israel takes up the Mosaic covenant. It's temporary. The Abrahamic covenant is eternal. It's added to the Abrahamic covenant. It's not a part of it. And it doesn't vitiate, annul, or set aside the Abrahamic covenant. Now, those things are very important to understand over in Galatians chapter 3. Because when you come to this covenant, this will be the first one of the three covenants that God makes with Israel, the Palestinian covenant, that expand upon the Abrahamic covenant. Now, it's been, there's 500 years, 400, almost 500 years between Abraham and Moses, and the time he makes the Abrahamic covenant and then adds the Mosaic covenant. Now, 40 years later, he's gonna put the Palestinian covenant into effect about the land. And as we go down through here, I want you to see these couple of things. Number one, be sure to notice that this is an additional covenant. But it has a very special focus with regard to the Mosaic covenant. Verse number one, these are the words of the covenant which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab. Underline that next word, beside the covenant which he made with them in Horeb. Now, Horeb, that's Sinai. That's Mount Sinai. That's back in Exodus 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24. When he brought them out of Egypt and they go to Sinai and they make the Mosaic covenant. Now, here's another covenant that he's going to make beside that one. Now, that's interesting terminology. It's beside it. That is, it's not that one. It's another one. But it's that terminology beside it. It's to sit beside the Mosaic covenant. This covenant is going to have something to do, especially to do with the Mosaic covenant. Actually, it's going to be a covenant that is designed to assure Israel that God was going to replace the Mosaic covenant and get rid of it. And really what he's going to do here, when this covenant sits beside the Mosaic covenant, after the 40, and you remember Deuteronomy is written 40, it's after the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. Exodus, Leviticus is prior to they come out, they haven't gone through the wilderness yet. Then they go through the wilderness for 40 years in the book of Numbers. And then Deuteronomy, Moses has got the new generation of Israel. All the old heads that came out of Egypt have died. The ones that went up to Kadesh Barnea wouldn't go in. They've all died. The new generation is there. Joshua is going to lead. Is ready to lead them into the promised land. And Moses recites to them the provisions and promises and purposes of God once again in the book of Deuteronomy. And at the end of the book, beginning in chapter 28, going all the way through to chapter 33, there's a section here where Moses, God gives Moses some prophetic information for the nation Israel about Israel's future, what it's going to be like. They've got 40 years. In Leviticus, for example, in Leviticus 26, he says, you keep my covenant, I'll bless you. You don't, and they're going to be these cycles of chastisement that I'm going to put on you. And there are five courses of chastisement that God puts on Israel back there. He's telling them it's going to come. Now, 40 years later, in Deuteronomy 28, Moses says, okay, you keep the covenant, you get the blessings, you don't, you get the curses, and then he lists all, you look how long chapter 28 is, 68 verses. And he begins way back in verse number 15 with the curses, from verse 15 all the way to 68, and he recites again all those five courses of judgment and chastisement. But when you read them in Deuteronomy, they're all jumbled together. In Leviticus, they're neatly identified, five courses. In Deuteronomy, they're just all wangled together. And the reason for that is that he's got 40 years of history that proves that Israel isn't going to keep them. Now, that's important to understand, because in Leviticus, you don't have much history with Israel's practice yet. When you get Deuteronomy, you've seen 40 years of their absolute failure. Now they're going to go into the land, and what he does in Deuteronomy is he makes the point that what you would say doctrinally made in Leviticus. In Deuteronomy, he more historically makes it. He says, you know, this is what God said, and look at you guys. What's happened to you? You've lived up to all of his low expectations, you know. There's a guy had a song once, said, I got friends in low places. Well, Israel did that. They, you know, they got right down where God said they were going to get. And so in Deuteronomy 28, he mixes all those courses of judgments up. And the reason for that is that every time God put one of those courses of chastisement on Israel, when the next one came, he didn't take the first one away. They weren't consecutive, they were concurrent. He put one, and if they didn't respond, then he put the next one on it. They still had to keep that one, then he put the next one on it. Then if they didn't respond, he added the third. They kind of piled up. So when the third one was there, or the fourth one were there, they were experiencing all four of them at one time. And finally, the fifth one was deportation and captivity. So you have them all mixed up in chapter 28. In light of the fact that they're going to fail, and he knows they're going to fail, and he tells them that they're going to fail, and they do fail, just before that new generation and the new nation enters into the land, God makes a covenant, and he makes some provisions with the nation Israel, and he enters into a covenant to assure them and guarantee them that they will get the land that he promised Moses. Now, the reason for that is this. Excuse me. If he promised Abraham the land, and then they put a side covenant over here that says you get the land only if you perform, what's going to be the problem? Well, they don't perform, so can they get the land? Can they or can't they? Well, you're going to see that what God says to them is, it's in essence this. I promised you the land. You entered into a contract that you would get it if you performed, and you can't perform. And if that was all there was to it, if that's all I ever said to you, and that's the only agreement I ever had with you, you'd never get it. But I do have another agreement. I got a different way of dealing with you. I already made you a promise, unconditionally. And this unconditional promise of my grace and purpose that I've made with you isn't going to be annulled by your stupidity or your failure. And he's going to go back over here now and give Israel. So when Israel goes through all of her history, she's got two covenants sitting there side by side. One is the Mosaic covenant. One is this Palestinian covenant. The Mosaic covenant says you can get the blessings if you perform. The Palestinian covenant says you ain't going to perform, but I'm going to make sure you get it anyway. God made provision at the beginning in view of Israel's failure. He literally makes a covenant with them and says to them, I'm going to replace that covenant that you failed with. And it's a fascinating thing how God says, he has made a legal right for himself to deal with Israel on a basis other than the Sinai law covenant. And he's made a covenant that he'll replace it. Now, there's some fascinating things. I want to read down through the chapter 28 and 29 with you just so you get the thrust of it. But this is really a notice given to Israel that he's going to replace the Mosaic covenant in light of the fact that the only way they can get the land is not going to be through their performance, but through his grace to them. These are the words which of the covenant which the Lord commanded Moses to make with the children of Israel in the land of Moab. This is 40 years after the 40 years of wandering, beside the covenant which he made with them in Horeb. Moses called unto all the children of Israel, unto all Israel, and said unto them, "You have seen all that the Lord did before your eyes in the land of Egypt, and to Pharaoh, and unto all his servants, and unto all his land, the great temptations which thine eyes have seen, the signs and those great miracles." See, these people that are there leading the nation out, they came out of Egypt. They were just the ones that were underage. They saw the miracles. They just weren't of the accountable age in Kadesh Barnea to be destroyed. And so all the leaders, others have died in the wilderness, and these people are there. "Yet the Lord has not given you an heart to perceive, and eyes to see, and ears to hear unto this day. And I have led you 40 years in the wilderness. Your clothes are not waxed old upon you. Thy shoes are not waxed old upon thy foot." I don't know what the women thought about that. Well, one pair of shoes for 40 years. We went to a thing yesterday. My wife, she got out three pair of shoes trying to see if they go with her dress. "Does that go with this?" I looked at, "Yeah, it goes." "Well, you didn't look." "Yeah, I did. It didn't go." "It goes. It's okay." She goes in and gets another. And I said, "Well, does this one go?" I said, "The other one went." You know, then we're walking up the walkway to the country club there for the dinner, and she's saying, "Well, so-and-so's got on her bone-colored shoes with her white dress, and I guess it was okay for me to wear mine." I said, "I told you that 4 hours ago." You can eliminate all that if you like. Most men just got one pair of shoes. They're one pair of shoes. I love this for 40 years. Wow. Better naturalize or a pair of shoes for that. You have not eaten bread, neither have you drunk wine or strong drink, that you might know that I am the Lord your God. And when you came unto this place, Sihon, the king of Heshbon, and Og, the king of Bashan, came out against us in the battle, and we smote them, and we took their land, and gave it for an inheritance unto the Reubenites, and the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. Keep therefore the words of this covenant, and do them, that you may prosper in all that you do. You stand this day, all of you, before the Lord your God, your captains, your tribes, your elders, your officers, with all the men of Israel, your little ones, your wives, and thy stranger that is in thy camp, from the hewer of thy wood unto the draw of thy water, that thou shouldest enter into the covenant which the Lord thy God, with the Lord thy God, and into his oath, which the Lord thy God maketh with thee this day." Notice he's making another covenant. This is not just a rehearsal of the Sinai covenant. This is another covenant in addition to the one he made back at Sinai with them, "that he may establish thee today for a people unto himself, and that he may be unto thee a God, as he hath said unto thee, and as he hath sworn unto thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." Notice this covenant is designed to carry out what? The provision, the land provisions of the Abrahamic covenant. See that? The Mosaic covenant wasn't designed to do that. It wasn't going to do it. This one is going to carry out the land provisions of the Mosaic of the Abrahamic covenant. "Neither with you only do I make this covenant and this oath, but with him that standeth here with us this day before the Lord our God, and also with him that is not here with us this day." It's going to be forever, for all the generations. "For you know how we have dwelt in the land of Egypt, and how we came through the nations which you passed by, and you have seen their abominations and their idols, wood and stone, silver and gold, which were among them. Lest there should be among you man or woman or family or tribe whose heart turneth away this day from the Lord our God to go and serve the gods of these nations. Lest there be among you a root that beareth gall and wormwood. It has come to pass when he, and it came to pass, it, it, And it come to pass, when he heareth the words of this curse, that he bless himself in his heart, saying, I shall have peace, though I walk in the imagination from mine heart, to add drunkenness to thirst. The Lord will not spare him. But then the anger of the Lord and his jealousy shall smoke against that man, and all the curses that are written in this book shall lie upon him. And the Lord shall blot out his name from under heaven. And the Lord shall separate him unto evil out of all the tribes of Israel according to all the curses of the covenant that are written in this book of the law. That's Leviticus 26. He says, you do those things, and all those curses that the law says are going to come on you, you break the law, all those curses are going to come. So that the generation to come of your children shall rise up after you, and the stranger that shall come from a far land shall say, when they see the plagues of that land, when they see Leviticus 26 fulfilled, the curses of the law fulfilled on you, all those the sicknesses which the Lord hath laid upon it, and that whole land thereof is brimstone and salt and burning, that it is not sown, nor beareth, nor any grass groweth therein, like the overthrow of Sodom and Gomorrah, Admah and Zeboam, which the Lord overthrew in his anger and in his wrath. They knew about God pouring his wrath out on Israel because of their overthrowing and their the chastisement and those curses and those courses back in Leviticus 26. Even all nations, and by the way, Brother Alex was teaching at the Bible conference about the wrath of God and the idea of God's wrath in the future. The whole of the fifth course of judgment was the wrath of God on Israel, but actually all five of the courses put on display God's chastening wrath and judgment against Israel when they would break the covenants. And he said, you've seen all that wrath. Even all nations shall say, wherefore hath the Lord done this unto this land? What meaneth the heat of this great anger? Then men shall say, because they have forsaken the covenant of the Lord God of their fathers, which he made with them when he brought them forth out of the land of Egypt. For they went and served other gods and worshipped them, the gods whom they knew not, and whom he had not given unto them. And the anger of the Lord was kindled against this land to bring upon it all the curses that are written in this book. All those curses of the Mosaic Law that Israel contracted to receive are brought against Israel because of their failure to keep the law and to keep his covenants and to keep that contract. They demonstrate themselves totally unfit to be the kingdom of priests God chose them to be. Now that's what they, under the Mosaic Covenant, they will do it ourselves. They demonstrate themselves unable to do it. And it's in light of that failure that this covenant is made. The Lord, verse 28, rooted them out of their land in anger. It was the fifth course of judgment, captivity. And in wrath, and in great indignation, and cast them into another land, as it is this day. The secret things belong unto the Lord our God. But those things which are revealed belong unto us, and to our children forever, that we may do all the words of this law. That's a strange verse, sticking right at the end of that chapter. And what he's saying there about the secret things belong unto the Lord, but those things that are revealed belong unto us. That verse doesn't have its ultimate culmination until Ephesians chapter 1, verse 9 and 10. When Paul says that God has abounded toward us in all wisdom and prudence, having made known unto us the mystery of his will, according to the good pleasure which he purposed in himself. The secret things that belong to the Lord have all now been revealed. But some of them are being revealed back here. See, it says there's certain things that God hadn't told us that we don't understand. But we can understand the things that he has revealed unto us. How God's going to reflect. If we've got this covenant over here that says you only get the land if you do what the covenant, you fulfill the contract, and you violated it, and God's wrath falls on Israel, and then he scatters them among the nations. How in the world can God take some people who are totally, completely unworthy, unable, unfit, how can he take them and give them the land? How can he do that? Well, that's the secret. We don't understand how he can do it. But let me tell you what God has said he's going to do, chapter 30, verse 1. Now, here's the covenant. In light of the failure, here's what God's going to do. He's going to replace the old and give you something, give you another one. It shall come to pass, when all these things are come upon thee, the blessing and the curse, which I have set before thee, and thou shalt call them to mind among all nations whither the Lord thy God hath driven thee. You're under the fifth course of judgment. You've been driven out. Just like the law said, Mosaic law said. And shall return unto the Lord thy God, and shall obey his voice according to all that I command thee this day, thou and thy children with all thine heart, with all thy soul, that then the Lord thy God will turn thy captivity and have compassion upon thee, and will return and gather thee from all the nations where the Lord thy God has scattered thee. If any of thine be driven out unto the utmost parts of heaven, from thence will the Lord thy God gather thee, and from thence will he fetch thee, and the Lord thy God will bring thee into the land which thy fathers possessed, which thou possess, and thou shalt possess it, and he will do thee good and multiply thee above thy fathers. You see, the issue is getting the land. And it says, when you've been scattered because you couldn't do it, and all that stuff you're out there, then you'll come back. Notice in verse 1 of chapter 30, verse 2 of chapter 30, look through those two verses. Do you see an if in those verses? What did the Mosaic covenant say? If you do, then you'll get it. Right? He's went down through all those verses in chapter 29 and said, you didn't do it. But I tell you what, you're going to get it anyway. You see what it says in verse 2? And shalt return unto the Lord. It doesn't say, if you return. It says, you're going to return to him. You see, that's a promise. Now, how are they going to be able to return? They hadn't been able to obey the Lord at all. So how can he say to them in verse 2, you're going to return? Look at verse 6. The Lord thy God will circumcise thine heart and the heart of thy seed, to love the Lord thy God with all thine heart, with all thy soul, that thou mayest live. You see what he's saying? You haven't been able to obey. You haven't been able to do it. All the Mosaic covenant demonstrates is you're a failure, your complete, total unfitness on your own. But I tell you what, God's going to do it for you. And here's the contract. You're going to get the land, not on the basis of what you do, because you'll never qualify, but God said, you shall get it. Because I will fix it so you will serve. I'll circumcise your heart, and I'll make it so you will do the things I tell you to do. Now, there's some complications. That covenant sitting over there that condemns them is a complication. God's going to have to do two things. One, he's going to have to get rid of that covenant, that Mosaic covenant. They don't know how he's going to do it. We now do. How does he get rid of it? Well, Christ takes that law contract. He says, blotting out the handwriting of ordinances that was against us, that was contrary. He took all those things, he took that Mosaic law and nailed it, took it out of the way, nailing it to his cross. Fulfilled. Paid it off. Get out of here. You're paid off. No longer the issue. Took that out of the way. Only left Abrahamic covenant and those things that came out of it. And so the cross did it. But what about between now and then? With Israel. Well, you see, when he says the secret things belong unto the Lord, there's some secret things God's got coming that he didn't tell them about here, about how he's going to get rid of that Mosaic covenant. But he also has reserved the right to deal with them on a basis other than the Mosaic covenant. he's reserved the right for him to deal with him on the basis of his mercy and his grace. And even in the way that he established the Mosaic covenant, he teaches Israel that. But before we get into that, I want you to notice one passage in Ezekiel chapter 16. And hold on to Deuteronomy 30. Deuteronomy 30 verse 5, these verses in here are real important. You can see how that in this, in God's mind, here in Deuteronomy 30, he knows about a new covenant that he's going to make. You can see he knows about what he's going to do. And see, we've got the benefit of completed revelation over here. We're looking back at what these people, he says a secret to them. But so we know some things. We know the, like Paul Harvey would say, we know the rest of the story that they don't know yet. Deuteronomy 30 verse 5, the Lord thy God will bring thee into the land which thy fathers possessed, and thou shalt possess it, and he will do thee good and multiply thee above thy fathers. How can they do that? Well, the only way they can do that is if they serve, if they return to the Lord and they obey his voice. So, verse 6, the Lord thy God will circumcise thine heart and the heart of thy seed to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul, and that thou mayest live. And the Lord thy God will put all these curses upon thine enemies and on them that hate thee, which persecuted thee, and thou shalt return and obey the voice of the Lord and do all his commandments which I command thee this day. And so Israel is going to get that provision. Now if you look at Ezekiel chapter 16 verse number 60, you'll see that when Israel receives the land in the kingdom that the Abrahamic covenant promised them, that they receive it not only on the basis of the Abrahamic covenant, but also on the basis of this Deuteronomy 29 and 30 covenant, the Palestinian covenant. Ezekiel 16, verse 60. And there's a long issue here about Israel, God forming the nation Israel, and the things that have happened to Israel in her history, and now the restoration of Israel, beginning verse 53, he begins to restore them from captivity and set them back up. Verse 60, nevertheless, I will remember my covenant with thee in the days of thy youth, and I will establish unto thee an everlasting covenant. Then thou shalt remember thy ways and be ashamed and receive, and so on and so forth. When he establishes them, he's going to do it on the basis of, I will remember my covenant with thee in the days of thy youth. Now you go back up earlier in the chapter, and that's referring to what happened to them in Exodus and Deuteronomy, not Genesis 15 with the Abrahamic covenant. He isn't thinking here about the Abrahamic covenant. The nation didn't exist in Abraham's day. They brought out of Egypt. Ezekiel 16 talks about like a babe in swaddling clothes. Then they begin to grow up as a youth before him, and he makes a covenant with them. And when they go into the land, he reaches back here for an everlasting covenant, not just to Abraham, but now he's saying, don't forget that thing I told you in Deuteronomy 30, because that's going to be the specifics by which you get the land over here. So the covenant in Deuteronomy 29 and 30 that's beside the Mosaic covenant is very important, because it notifies Israel of the fact that Mosaic covenant isn't going to get them in, but God's going to make sure they get the land anyway, based on his giving it to them, his doing for them what they can't do for themselves. Come back with me to the book of Exodus. There's a fascinating thing back here in Exodus 32. When God first, when he formed the nation and he established Israel and gave them the Mosaic covenant, the law covenant, even in the very earliest dealings, God demonstrated that he was going to have to deal with, and that he was going to deal with Israel on a different basis than the Mosaic covenant, or else what would happen to them? if you break one of the commandments, what were they to do to you? They're all going to be dead, folks. You break the commandment, you die. Well, when they all broke the commandment, what ought to happen to all of them? They ought to die. Did you ever wonder why they didn't all die? You never wondered about that. On what basis could God deal with them and let them get off? Does he violate the law? Does he just say, well, it doesn't make any difference? No. God looking at it, they deserve to die, they should have died, but God would say, wait a minute, but I don't have to kill them because I've got another way of dealing with them. I can deal with them on the basis of this other agreement. That was added to it, but here's the one that's underlying it, everything. And I can do it on the basis of this one. Exodus 32. This is a fascinating passage because what you learn is that the Mosaic Covenant is not God's only word with Israel. It's not the only contract between God and Israel. The Abrahamic Covenant is the underlying way that God deals with Israel, and it stands outside. It stands beyond the Mosaic Covenant. Exodus 32, verse 1. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down. Now, hold your hand and come back to chapter 24, just so that you get to where you are. Exodus 24, Moses makes takes the book of the law, the covenant. They ratify the Mosaic Covenant. Verse number 17, and the sight of the glory of the Lord was like devouring fire from the top of the mountains in the eyes of the children of Israel. And Moses went up into the midst of the cloud and got him up into the mount. And Moses was in the mount 40 days and 40 nights. And chapter 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, and 31 takes place with God talking to Moses on the mount during that 40 days. So Moses is up on the mountain, and he stays there 40 days. Now, while he's up there, you get a flashback in chapter 32. It's Israel doing down on the ground while Moses is up there on the mountain. Now, the last thing you see in chapter 31, verse 18, and he goes unto Moses when he had made an end of communing with him on Mount Sinai, two tables of testimony, tables of stone, written with the finger of God. Moses has the original manuscripts, the Ten Commandments, written with God's finger on two tables of stone. Now he's going to come down the mountain with them. In the meantime, back at the ranch, Ray Stevens would say, meantime, back at the motel, if you know the song. I'm sorry, wife, I just... can't help it, it's in my head. 32:1. When the people saw that Moses delayed to come down out of the mount, and the people gathered themselves together unto Aaron and said unto him, up, make us gods which shall go before us. For as to this Moses, the man that brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we wot not what is become of him. And Aaron said unto them, break off the golden earrings which are in the ears of your wives and your sons and your daughters, and bring them unto me. And all the people break off the golden earrings which were in their ears and brought them unto Aaron. He received them at their hands and fashioned it with a graving tool after he had made it a molten calf. And they said, these be thy gods, O Israel, which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. That's the works of their own hands. It's a fascinating thing. It's always terribly humorous to me. When somebody gets caught doing something wrong, you know what they say? Hand up! It says that Aaron fashioned it with a graven tool. Verse 24, when Moses has caught him, verse 24, he says to Moses, I said unto them, whosoever hath any gold, let them break it off. And they gave it to me, and I threw it in the fire, and it just came out a calf. That's great, isn't it? I didn't do a thing, man. I just threw it in and it just came out. I love that. I mean, that's so typical of human nature. You know, you deal with people very long and you find out, they just say, I didn't do anything, it just happened. And he sits there and he worked and he fashioned it and he engraved it. And then Aaron, verse 5, saw it. He built an altar before it. And Aaron made a proclamation and said, tomorrow is a feast of the Lord of Jehovah. And they rose up early in the morning and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and to drink and rose up to play. They take the gods of Egypt and they take Jehovah and they amalgamate them together. And they have a form of godliness. A form of super spirituality there in the valley. And they mix. They're developing this vain religious system. It's corrupted them. And it's not godliness, it's godlessness. And the Lord said unto Moses, get thee down. For, notice this next expression, thy people. The Lord come disown them. What did he tell Pharaoh? Moses, go down and tell Pharaoh, let my people go. Not that anymore. They're yours, Moses. Let them to you. You see, you know what Israel's done? They've gone over there, and they went over there, and they took Egypt's gods, and they mixed them with their God, with Jehovah, and they demonstrated that they weren't any better than those Gentiles out there. They're just as spiritually blind, just as spiritually dead, just as spiritually deceived as the Gentiles in Egypt. God didn't bring them out because there's anything special in them. They had absolutely no spiritual fitness at all to serve God. And they demonstrate that. So God says, go get thee down, for thy people which thou broughtest out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They've manifested openly their own spiritual unfitness to be kings and priests unto God. I love the way he says that. Thy people which thou broughtest out of the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They obviously are not God's people by nature. And they turned aside. They have turned aside quickly out of the way. When he said they turned aside, that's like that passage in 1 Timothy where he says that some being desirous to be teachers of the law have turned aside, have swerved. You remember that? When you swerve, you turn aside quickly. God sought to educate them in their need for his grace, for him to provide it for them. We saw that in Exodus 15, 16, 17, 18. They've rejected that. They've done exactly what Paul says about the Galatians who are so soon removed. They didn't want they're not any different than anybody else out there in their own abilities. They turned aside quickly out of the way which I commanded them. They have made them a molten calf and have worshipped it and sacrificed thereunto and have said, these be thy gods, the Israel which brought thee up out of the land of Egypt. Moses said, the Lord said unto Moses, I have seen this people, and behold, it is a stiff-necked people. Now therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may wax hot against them, that I may consume them, and I will make of thee a great nation. I just wipe them out, get rid of them, and I'll use you, Moses. We'll start over. Moses besought the Lord, his God, and said, why doth thy wrath wax hot against thy people? He throws it back at the Lord. He says, now wait a minute, Lord. That's your people. Which thou broughtest out of the land of Egypt with great power and a mighty hand. Wherefore should the Egyptians speak and say, for mischief did he bring them out, to slay them in the mountain and to consume them from the face of the earth. Turn from thy fierce wrath and repent of this evil against thy people. Notice, remember who. Now Moses never one time says, Lord, you don't have a right to destroy them. Because Moses is holding in his hand the legal contract that gave God the right to destroy them. Right? But Moses says, wait a minute, Lord. you had a deal with them before this, and they're so dumb and stupid and unfit to deal with you that they made a boneheaded agreement. But you know better. You already knew. You see, Moses is beginning to, he's got it. What you see here in the argument with Moses and God and so forth, it isn't that Moses is arguing and God's going to, it's God is, the Lord is educating Moses and bringing to Moses' attention what's going on. And he's trying to educate Moses, and what he's demonstrating to him and making Moses come to realize, putting him in a rock and a hard place, so he sees that, look, I've got another way of dealing with these people beside that contract over there, and I better have, or they're toast. And he says, Lord, remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israelite servants to whom thou swearest by thine own self. Forget what these dumb bunch of bunnies over here said. They're too stupid to know what to do. They can't do it anyway. Just remember what you said. You see how that is? What's Moses pleading? He's not saying, Bill, they can perform. Bill, that law contract. He's saying, Lord, I know you. You already said that they can't do it. Look at them, a poor bunch of nitwits. But you know, you already knew that. Because you already said you had to do it. At the very beginning of Israel's history, God begins to educate them in the fact that he's going to have to deal with them differently than that law contract, or they're toast. They're gone. Now, Moses comes down and deals with them and so forth. Chapter 33. The Lord said unto Moses, Depart and go up hence, thou and the people which thou hast brought up out of the land of Egypt, unto the land which I swear unto Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, saying, Unto thy seed will I give it. And I will send an angel before thee, and I will drive out the Canaanites. And so Moses is told, Okay, let's go. They got that thing dealt with back there, and it's over. The judgment went. You see, the law is a schoolmaster to do what? Bring them to Christ. God always was added because of transgression. It was added to teach them their spiritual unfitness. God never was depending on the law contract with Israel to get them into the land or to bless them. He always knew he had another way to do that. You with me there? Well, this is real important to get. This is the whole thing in the Palestinian covenant that gives you this underlying issue to understand what the Mosaic, that's why it lays beside the Mosaic covenant and says, we're going to do away with that turkey because it didn't work. But don't worry, God's going to get you there anyway. Now, in chapter 33, God begins to give them things to do again. Verse 7, Moses took the tabernacle and pitched it without the camp. Moses knew he better get God outside of Israel's camp before God wiped them out. You know, he's going to put the tabernacle outside out there. And we don't have time to get into it, but when you study this back in Exodus, you find out that Israel, all through her history from this point on, really carried two tabernacles with them. One was a tabernacle in which Jehovah and the Shekinah glory of God dwelt, and another was a false religion's tabernacle that goes all the way back, that they keep. They never completely got rid of it. And you see it show up in Amos over there, and with the star that today is the so-called Star of David, the tabernacle of Moloch and the star and all that stuff. And they have this stuff competing. They never got, it's a sad thing. Their failure. But it's a glorious thing to set in relief the grace of God providing. Anyway, Moses took the tabernacle and pitched it without the camp, afar off from the camp, and called it the tabernacle of the congregation. And it came to pass that everyone which sought the Lord went out unto the tabernacle of the congregation which was without the camp. And it came to pass when Moses went out unto the tabernacle that all the people rose and stood at him at his tent door and looked after Moses until he was gone into the tabernacle. Now Moses is going to begin to get some information for them. And it came to pass as Moses entered into the tabernacle, the cloudy pillar descended and stood at the door of the tabernacle, and the Lord talked with Moses, and all the people saw the cloudy pillar stand at the tabernacle door, and all the people rose up and worshipped, and every man in his tent door. And the Lord spake unto Moses face to face. So he begins to communicate with Moses in front of all the people, so they know clearly that Moses is God's spokesman. Verse 12, Moses said unto the Lord. Now, just a great conversation going to have here. Another, some more education for Moses. Moses said unto the Lord, see, thou sayest unto me, bring up this people, and thou hast not let me know whom thou wilt send with me. Yet thou hast said, I know thee by name, and thou hast also found grace in my sight. Notice Moses understands something about God dealing with him on the basis of grace. On the basis of him providing for them what they're going to need. Now therefore, I pray thee, if I have found grace in thy sight, show me now thy way, that I may know thee, that I may find grace in thy sight, and consider that this nation is thy people. Moses wants God to explain some things to him. And Moses probably got whiplash at this point. You got this contract, let's get this other one. This one says you can destroy him. There you are, want to do it. And I say, wait a minute, Lord, don't you remember? You got that. And then you back off and you go back over here. And you say, would you please explain to me your thinking? Show me thy way. He's confused. And he wants to know, what are you thinking? How are you dealing with these people? What's going on? And he said, verse 14, my presence shall go with thee, and I will give thee rest. Now, by the way, he told him, you know, explain what's going on here. So the Lord said, my presence shall go with thee, and I will give thee rest. Now watch carefully. He said unto him, if thou, Moses says, if thy presence go not with me, carry us not up. It's hard to say to the Lord, that's not enough. But Moses caught something that God said. For wherein thou shall it be known here that I and thy people have found grace in thy sight. You see what he said in verse 14? My presence will be with thee. Is that singular or plural? You better not get rid of the thees and the yees in your Bible. Who's he talking to in verse 14? Moses or the nation? Moses. Mo, I'll go with you. Moses says, whoa, wait a minute. I wouldn't want you to just go with me. It's the people. Who? How am I going to know that I and thy people have found grace in thy sight? Is it not in that thou goest with, notice, us? See that? It's the big thing out here, Lord, not just me. So shall we be separated, I and thy people, from all the people that are upon the face of the earth. And the Lord said unto Moses, I will do this thing also. I won't just go with you, but I'll go with all, with the nation that thou hast spoken, for thou hast found grace in my sight, and I know thee by name. God is teaching Moses. I'm dealing with you on the basis of grace, Moses. I'll go with you. Wait a minute. What about the nation? You didn't include them. Well, okay. I'll deal with them the same way I'm dealing with you. Moses asking, tell me, would you explain your way? How are you dealing with us? And we've got that law contract added over there. We've got this Abrahamic contract. You promised, you swore you'd do it by yourself. Over there, we've got to do it. The people over there got to do it for themselves. I know we can't do that. They bought the bad deal. Now, which one of these things is going to be the underlying basis upon which you operate? And God says, you know what? This is the one that's going to last. This is the one I'm going to operate. I'll take care of all that over there. But they got to learn they messed up. They got to learn what you've learned, Moses, that you've got to be dealt with by my grace. That I got to do it for you, or it isn't going to get done. And that takes Israel a while, the nation, a while to get that. But at the very beginning, he demonstrates to them that that's got to be the way it's going to be. Verse 18, he said, I beseech thee, show me thy glory. Show me the outward manifestation of your purpose and plan. And he said, I will make all my goodness pass before thee, and I will proclaim the name of the Lord before thee. Okay, I'll show you my glory. And I'll demonstrate to you my goodness. And I'll proclaim my name, Jehovah. I'll demonstrate to you what it means for me to be Jehovah. And I'll let you see it. And God's going to demonstrate to Moses that he's got a right to deal with Israel outside of that law contract, outside of that law program, because he already had something else in place that couldn't be vitiated or destroyed, and the law doesn't annul it. It was added to it just to teach him a lesson. And it was only going to be there till the Redeemer came that was going to take away the problem that they had that they didn't know they had, which was the sin problem, the spiritual unfitness. You guys getting this? I'm not going around your... Okay, verse 20. By the way, there's two things in verse 19. The second one we'll have to come back to next time. And we'll be merciful. Notice he says, I will, I'm going to do two things. Make all my goodness pass before thee, and I will proclaim the name of the Lord before thee. I'll show you my grace, and I'll show you the way that I'm dealing with you. And, now that's an additional thing he's going to do. Will be gracious unto whom I will be gracious, and will show mercy on whom I will show mercy. I'll show you my grace, I'll show you my mercy, I'll show you who I am, and I'm going to demonstrate to you that I can give that mercy and that grace to whoever I choose to give it to. Now those two things, those two provisions right there, the very divided, do you remember? You're going to stand on a rock that's got a split in it. Moses been there 40 years before. You remember that? Exodus 17. He took the rod and he whacked the rock. You do remember that. Well, at least you remember from Sunday school, right? Okay. And when he did, what's that a picture of? We know who the rock is. Paul tells us the rock is Christ. And the smitten rock is Calvary. So he's going to hide them. The typology, the picture, the things that they don't know that we now know in this is really, how's he going to take away that law, the wrath that their spiritual unfitness called for? By hiding them in the cleft of a rock. Anyway, I will put thee in the cleft of the rock and will cover thee with my hand while I pass by. There's Brother Mel's song that he likes. And I will take away mine hand, and thou shalt see my back parts, but my face shall not be seen. If Moses can't look at God's wrath and his anger as his glory goes through to destroy everything that offends, but he can see what's behind you is what's left. What's left after the wrath is poured out? Well, if you take all the wrath away, what's left? Just the goodness of God. What's left behind where the wrath is gone is his grace and his mercy. He says, Moses, I'm going to take all my wrath away. That cleft of the rock is going to do that, and then I'm just going to have grace and mercy left. The Lord said unto Moses, hew out two stones, and he gives him verse 1 to 4, the new commandments, verse 5. The Lord descended, 34:5, the Lord descended in the cloud and stood with him there and proclaimed the name of the Lord. And here's when he does what he told Moses he's going to do. I'm going to proclaim my name, show you my goodness. The Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord, Jehovah, the Lord God. And by the way, you notice Jehovah Adonai, that's Jesus Christ, the second person of the Godhead. Merciful and gracious, long-suffering and abundant in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands, forgiving iniquities and transgressions and sin, and that will in no wise clear the guilty, visiting the iniquities of the fathers unto the children, and upon the children's children unto the third and the fourth generation. there's who he is. When he proclaims his identity, he talks about his character, goodness, mercy, long-suffering, graciousness, truth, forgiveness, justice. All those attributes of God. He said, that's who I am. You want to get to know me? Get to know my mercy and my graciousness, my long-suffering, my goodness, my truth, my forgiveness, my justice. Isn't it wonderful to have the justice of God look at you and say, hey man, you're okay. Well, you're spiritually fit. How you get there? You don't get there by your performing. You get there by God's mercy and His grace and His long-suffering and His goodness and His truth and His forgiveness. And that gets you where the justice of God is for you. See that? Moses says, man, I got it. That's what you got to learn. So you got to understand, the Palestinian covenant comes in the understanding. Come with me to two passages, Numbers 23 and Micah 6. Comes in with the understanding that God is going to has the legal contractual right to deal with Israel on a basis other than the Mosaic Covenant, because he already has contracts that stand outside of the Mosaic Covenant that are not destroyed, they're not affected negatively, they're not annulled by the Mosaic Covenant. They have to be dealt with. Understand that, and he will deal with it. But dealing with it doesn't do away with the promise. And the Mosaic Covenant is added not so that Israel can get her blessings, but so that Israel can be taught by the schoolmaster that they can't get their blessings on the basis of their own spiritual fitness. They can only get it when God gives it to them. Micah chapter 6. I just want you to see this. Micah 6 verse 5. And this is looking into the future last days. O my people, remember now what Balak, king of Moab, consulted with Balaam, the son of Beor, and what Balaam, the son of Beor, answered him from Shittim unto Gilgal, that you may know the righteousness of the Lord. You want to see God's righteousness? Go back to Numbers 22 to 24 and look at what Balaam told Balak. Go back to Numbers 23 with me. When he tried to get Balaam to curse Israel. And there's one place back here that Micah refers to that demonstrates the righteousness of God. The righteous standard of God. God has a right to deal with Israel on the basis of His grace, and you'll see it here. Numbers 22 to 24 is a passage, according to Revelation chapter 2 and 2 Peter chapter 3, 2 Peter chapter 2, and the book of Jude. Balaam is mentioned three times. Jude, 2 Peter 2, Revelation 2. Balaam will be, the character Balaam in Numbers 22, 23, and 24, this passage will be used to educate the believing remnant in the last days during the tribulation about some doctrine that they need to understand. Balaam, Balak, and Baal, the unholy trinity, is in this passage. And what happens here is this new generation that Moses is dealing with in Deuteronomy is ready to go into the land. And you'll see them back in the chapters previous to this, in Numbers 20 and 21. And they come up and they take over. Now, immediately in chapter 22, as soon as the new generation is separated, the book of Numbers, Moses sets forth the satanic policy as evil to seek to destroy that new generation. And here comes Balaam, Balak, and Balaam. The false king, Balak, the false prophet, Balaam, and the false god, Baal, and that unholy trinity. And in the midst of all that, Micah says, you go back there and look at what God teaches about how He's going to deal with His people. Do you remember that passage in Revelation talks about Satan being the accuser of the brethren? That's what Balaam does. Come with me to verse 8, chapter 23, verse 18. And he took up his parable and said, "Rise up, Balak, and hear. Hearken unto me, thou son of Zippor. God is not a man that he should lie, neither the son of man that he should repent. Hath he said, and shall he not do it? Or hath he spoken, and shall he not make it good? Behold, I have received commandment to bless, and he hath blessed, and I cannot reverse it." As bad as Balaam wanted to curse him, God wouldn't let him. As bad as Satan wants to curse him, God won't let him. The accuser of the brethren says, "I got them. They're the lawful captive. You can't have them." God says, "You want to bet? I got a plan. Secret things belong to me. I got some plans." Verse 21 is one of the most staggering verses in the Bible to me. "He hath not beheld," God hath not beheld iniquity in Jacob, "neither hath he seen perverseness in Israel. The Lord his God is with him, and the shout of a king is among him. God brought them out of Egypt. He hath, as it were, the strength of a unicorn. Surely there is no enchantment against Jacob, neither is there any divination against Israel. According to this time, it shall be said of Jacob and of Israel, what hath God wrought?" Who's done it for them? God did it. When they go into the kingdom, when the time of conquest comes for Israel to be the conqueror, to have the shout of a king among them, to have God with them, that's the kingdom. People are going to look at Israel and say, "God did that. Look what God did. It took him to do it. I'll do it." Verse 21, "He hath not beheld iniquity in Jacob, neither hath he seen perverseness in Israel." There is not a better statement of what justification is in all the Bible than right there. God's justice looks at Israel and says, "I don't see iniquity, and I don't see..." You say, "Wait a minute. There are dead Jews from there all the way back to Egypt across that wilderness. All the way back to the book of Numbers, there's a whole generation of them that died in the wilderness." And God looks at it and says, "I don't see any problem." He said, "Wait a minute, what's going on?" God Almighty counts them righteous in spite of all of their own personal spiritual unfitness. Now, how could he do that? Oh, he had a plan. The secret things belong to God. But there's the righteousness of God in action. God had a right to deal with the nation Israel on a different basis than the law covenant, because he'd sworn with an oath about what he was going to do. Now, you and I know how it is that he does that. Come over with me to Romans chapter 3. Without Paul in your Bible, you'd never be able to understand that. The secret things belong to God, but God has revealed the secret to us. Romans 3:21. "But now the righteousness of God without the law is manifest, being witnessed by the law and the prophets, even the righteousness of God, which is by faith of Jesus Christ, unto all and upon all them that believe. For there's no difference, for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, being justified freely by his grace through the redemption that's in Christ Jesus, whom God has set forth to be a propitiation through faith in his blood, to declare his righteousness for the remission of sins that are what? Past. Through the forbearance of God." That's the sins in time past. In Numbers, for example, God now tells us, "Here's how I forgave those sins. Here's how my forbearance is the extension of time for the payment of a debt." How is it that God could do all that back there? Because he knew the propitiation of Calvary was coming. He had a secret. 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 7 and 8. He knew something about what was going to happen at the cross that he never told anybody. And that old that old adversary that said, there's no secret they can keep from me, God actually told him, I got a secret. You can't figure it out. And he didn't. Because the wisdom of God is greater than the wisdom of man. And God fixed a plan where Satan thought, everything depended on what people were going to do, and if I can just capture them and make them my lawful captive, I got them. And God said, nothing depends on them, it all just depends on me. And I've given my word. Father, we're grateful tonight because of your grace. And when we see it manifested in your purpose and your plan, even as you begin dealing with the nation Israel in the Bible, it's so wonderfully laid out that it really has to be who you are that's the issue. We thank you tonight that you've allowed us by the study of this book to understand something about your wisdom that's made it so. And made your love and grace the marvel of heaven and earth. We're privileged and we're grateful for the opportunity not just to rejoice in it, and not just to make it known here in this scene, but that knowledge has an impact even out into the heavenly places tonight, and demonstrates the superiority of your wisdom, your power, and your grace for your honor and glory. We praise you for it in Christ's name.